From time to time on this show, we look at specific museum jobs or titles and ask the question, what is that exactly? Today we're looking at the role of the cultural anthropologist. Cultural anthropology is an offshoot of anthropology dedicated to the study of human societies and cultures, exploring beliefs, values, and practices. I recently took a short drive over to the campus of Gilcrease Museum here in Tulsa, which has been closed and under construction for a few years. The brand new facility is slated to open in 2027 and is looking great so far. But it's not just construction happening over there. Just a few steps away from the main building is the Helmreich Center for American Research. That's where I met up with Aaron Schoenfeld, who's currently serving as a Duane H. King postdoctoral fellow. That's a mouthful. I wanted to chat with Aaron about what it means to pursue a life in cultural anthropology and his focus through that lens on the impact and legacy of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. That's exactly what we did. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential.
Well, thank you for being with us today on Museum Confidential. We're excited to kind of dive in from time to time to titles and positions that the general public may not have a real sense of. They see the name on a business card or on a website and they think, oh, that sounds interesting, but I don't know what that actually is. So can you tell us just at the jump, what is cultural anthropology and what drew you to it?
So that is a question that I think everyone asks me, right? I mean, it's the dinner party question. People think I'm, you know, an Indiana Jones, and I have to tell them, no, I don't work with artifacts and I don't go on digs. And sometimes people think that I am like Bones, right, that show. And
that's archaeology versus anthropology.
Yes, or biological anthropology, yeah. Right? And I tell them, no, but, you know, and then they think I deal with, you know, something very, very far away, and that's what I study. And then I tell them, no, I'm in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and that is what I study. You know, that's my exotic place, in air quotes. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, I think cultural anthropology, to me, really is a very flexible framework for seeing the world. And I think more than anything, it's a way of seeing the world. It's a way of asking questions. And it's a way of asking kind of why things happen, bracketing the question of judgment, and I think foregrounding the question of understanding. And for me, what really drew me is I had a very, very formative professor at my undergraduate institution. And you know, and she was just really cool. And she talked a lot about dance. That was kind of her thing, right? And so we got into this whole discussion. And the way she taught Intro to Cultural Anthropology was all about dance. And of course, I don't really know anything about dance. Don't have much rhythm. But I was just so fascinated at how you could see the world through something. And she had this article from this guy, this anthropologist named Jose Limon. And it was about Mexican-American men in South Texas at a carne asada. And it was reading this deep cultural meaning into this moment. And, you know, just what from the onset just looked like it was just men and meat, but had all of this greater meaning to
right.
it. And I think that's when I was like, oh, no, it's such an interesting way to see all of this kind of cultural meaning, all of these things that can often be taken for granted, and to read both difference and similarity. And yeah, and this piece just really kind of brought home this thing that could feel so familiar, and yet make it so layered with meaning that I was like, oh yeah, I gotta do this. And then so I kept going and got my master's at University of Chicago, got my PhD at University of Northwestern this spring, and now I'm here at Helmreich Center for American Research at the University of Tulsa at the Gilcrease Museum.
Would you trace the professional path that you're on now to just a general curiosity as a kid? Did you just want to know more about everything as a young person? Were you always wondering what the motivations and symbology was behind people's actions? You know, where was the seed planted to go down this road?
Yeah, I think I was a really curious kid. But I also understood that there were sometimes questions you couldn't ask. You know, I mean, one of the things, I mean, not to get too into my biography, right? But I grew up an incredibly loving co-parent, two households. And I think when I had that growing up, you understand that there's just this like sense of doubleness in the world, sense of difference. When you're in one space, you act this way, and in another, you know, when you're in your dad's space, you act this way, and when you're in your mom's space, you act this way. And you recognize you have your mom's sense of the world and you have your dad's sense of the world, right? And so, and the truth is somewhere, I think, in the middle.
Two sides to every story.
Exactly. You know, I think would be a way of saying it. Yeah, so I think, you know, I lived that in a way. I think that's what drew me to it, is just this idea of understanding. And also appreciation of difference, too. Because that was, I think, part of this way that I grew up.
Mm-hmm. And was there one teacher, professor, educator along the way that pushed you down this road more than any other?
Yeah, definitely my professor in college. She was very influential. I ended up TAing for her. She...
This was at the University of Chicago?
No, this was actually at Kalamazoo College.
Kalamazoo.
Yes. So, yes, there really is a Kalamazoo.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Yeah. So, Western Michigan. It's not too far from Lake Michigan. Her name was Adriana Garriga Lopez, and she was very formidable for me and, you know, taught me so much and made me see that anthropology could be something that I could, that I felt like I could be, mm-hmm. you know, and I could access this way of asking questions.
I got a gal in Kalamazoo. Don't want to boast, but I know she's the toast of Kalamazoo. Zoo, 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 zoo. Years have gone by.
This episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by Surveys. Here in Museumland, we are very data-driven people. Give us those stats. Unleash the 411. Hand over the info. And the best way we can get that data? Surveys, ladies and gentlemen, in person, via email, or at a self-guided digital kiosk. The possibilities of enacting surveys are endless, and it's just a few short questions. You've got the time. This will only take a moment. Think for 1 second about all the work we put into your amazing museum experience here. Seriously, you can't pause on your way out the door for a 5-minute freaking survey? Sorry, listen, we're just very passionate about surveys. What if everyone in the world were so passionate? That would be, to our way of thinking, quite heavenly.
When you think about a life devoted to research, and we're in a place now, the whole mission behind it is research, do you think about that in terms of, I'm going to be gathering a lifetime's worth of information, and the goal of my professional life, if not my entire life, is to hoover up as much as I can, versus what can you do with that information? You know, do you think as much about the action you can take with the knowledge as much as you do as acquiring the knowledge?
That, I think, is, yeah, very interesting way to frame it. Yeah, I think for me it's that latter, right? It's the question of applying this knowledge, right? Not just simply accumulating it for the sake of accumulating knowledge, but that there are, that I want to, like, look at, I think, or one of the things that I think that anthropological mind can do in this way of asking questions, right, is it can lend very well, I think, to real-world problems. You see a lot of applied anthropologists, and yeah, because I think it is this way of trying to look at this whole picture and seeing this relationship between the part to the whole. And then in that way, right, I think what's important about the part, you know, is often its utility. And trying to accumulate knowledge for something, not just for the sake of accumulating it.
Mm-hmm. So your work here at the center is based around the 1921 Tulsa race massacre, Greenwood, and looking at that through this lens of anthropology. When did you first come to even hear about this? Was it connected to the centennial of it, or had you heard about it much prior to that? Because it seems like much of the larger world, it was the 2021 centennial that really broke this open in terms of national news, broader awareness. Where did you first come across this event?
I knew about it as a young child, right? So I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, but my dad's from Tulsa. And, you know, my dad always knew about it. His father's friend was a man by the name of Ed Wheeler, and he was one of the first journalists to write about it in the 1970s. And, yeah, you know, and being someone who has these kind of roots in town, and I, you know, my grandmother, right, one of the stories she told me, and this is a very common story for white folks in Tulsa, right? In fact, it's one of the only surviving genres of story, is that, you know, her father had helped, her father lived up in Catoosa, and saw a destitute black man and his family on the side of the road. He told them that, you know, there had been this massacre in Greenwood, and, you know, helped them on their way and get to where they wanted to go. You know, and so that was this story I know, and that's, you know, the story that is passed down kind of frequently in the white community.
You view that as apocryphal? Do you view that as something that is a kind of Good Samaritan story that people tell each other that may or may not be based in truth?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, the way I see it is that in the oral history collection, in the oral tradition that's passed down, that is the most predominant story we have. And I'm not telling anybody that their grandparents are lying. I'm just saying.
But there's no documentation.
There's no documentation. And the fact that that is the narrative, the fact that as a whole, that is the narrative that survives, is, I think, this kind of tale of
selective forgetting. How many people could have had a grandparent that helped the person in the same exact way? And yeah.
Exactly.
And so that brings up something interesting to me, which is there is such a lack of documentation from this time. So much stuff was either disappeared on purpose or just wasn't, you know, there was not a sense of value in preserving events in Black Tulsa at the time. So, you know, you have things like the Tulsa Star and some of those publications existed, but the archives are iffy at best. How do you go about determining truth versus fiction? That seems like a very difficult thing when you're trying to get to something at the core of what you're trying to get to.
Well, I think you have to understand that there's, you know, I think cultural truths and kind of historical truths. And so, like, you know, I think to go back to the instance of the stories of the like, let's call them the benevolent ancestor, the benevolent white ancestor. What is fascinating to me is that not that that is wrong, but that that conveys this idea, this truth about how white folks want to be remembered and how we would like, and I say that we being, I am a white person, that there is something. There is this inability to reckon with the other side of that, of what is actually, of what actually happened that day, you know. And I find that's really this thing that kind of animates my work is how do we understand the perpetrators, right? And I think, you know, in this time where we know so much, you know, I mean, I go down to Greenwood and Archer, and right, and you just find these names of victims and survivors. You know, they're everywhere. And they've done such a beautiful job of remembering this past. And I think that's so powerful. And I cross the proverbial tracks. And I think for me, the question is, how does this white community kind of forget this past?
In 2021, that was arguably one of the most talked about anniversaries in American culture that year. It was at the center of so much media. I remember being down in that area, and you would see trucks from every news outlet across the world, from BBC to CNN to Al Jazeera, I mean, everything. Here we are 5 years later, and I can start to feel the forgetting happening again, you know? And, you know, of course, there were some permanent things put in place. There's the Greenwood Rising Museum, which opened right around that time, which is hopefully an ongoing reminder of this history. But it does seem that, and this often happens with notable anniversaries, those are used as opportunities, and then, you know, now 105, it doesn't have the same ring to it for the media as 100, but it doesn't change the impact of the events. Do you see that the city and the work you're doing is as engaged with this topic as they were 5 years ago?
Yes and no, right? I think, you know, I mean, I look at Mayor Nichols, you know, the kind of reparations, I believe it'd be a task force, right? And I think that that is, I mean, crucial, right? And that was something that I think was almost unthinkable 5 years ago, or that was the line of which was, you know, one could not cross. So I see that and I applaud that. And in that ways, yes, but I think, yeah, in some ways it's also, it's gone towards the back of everyone's mind to some extent. You know, and yeah, in 100 years, you know, it was such a big moment for Tulsa. I think, you know, in terms of the story that Tulsa wanted to tell itself about itself. And it was such this moment of self-fashioning. And, you know, and I was not here for that. So I actually came literally, that was June of, you know, May and June of 2021, and I came in July to start my research, right? And that was, you know, that was the thing I was fascinated with is, you know, what happens kind of after these moments? You know, and I think one of the things for me, and because I think you are right that there's such, like the stories, that Tulsa today is not the city that my father grew up in. But, you know, it's taught, you know, since 2019, it's been taught from, you know, the third grade on, right? It's in the public schools, or at least it's supposed to be taught. You know, and I think Tulsa has reconciled with the fact that this atrocious thing has happened here. I think what it still has trouble with is understanding what it means that someone's grandparents might have done this, right? So I think in some ways the civic relationship, and I think we see that with this question of reparations, that reparations being a kind of reparative act of the social contract between a city government or a government of some kind and a kind of populace, right? There is this move to at least repair that. But I think, you know, one of the things that I'm fascinated with is that I don't always feel like there's that more cultural kind of reckoning. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's what I would see as kind of reconciliation, yeah. Right? So there being kind of two aspects there. So I, you know, in some ways I feel like Tulsa's really good with the, or has made steps that are very promising towards this question of repair. But the reconciliation may be a little bit more, is a little bit more difficult.
So on the flip side of that, and I know through this process, you're interviewing lots of people and getting to know different parts of the community. I think one could argue that it might not be healthy for the future of the Black Tulsa economy to always have to be reckoning with this, right? If you're a young entrepreneur and you want to open a new business or somewhere on Greenwood, you know, you may feel like, you know, there's so much weight of this on you. You just want to be a thriving young person and not have to carry the weight of history on you. And when you go down there through the signage and everything else, of course, it's unavoidable to not think about that. And it's very interesting to think about Oklahoma as a state even, you know. When you think about what we're known for nationally, you think about the Oklahoma City bombing of 1995. Now a lot of people know about the Osage Reign of Terror, which was referenced in Killers of the Flower Moon, the book and the film. And of course, the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, three tragic American chapters, two of which happened almost simultaneously to different populations. And you know, ultimately it's not great to be known for tragedies, you know? And I think a lot of young people, you know, they might be feeling like, you know, I wanna kind of start my own thing, I wanna be fresh, you know? And so, what is the balance between kind of keeping topics in the cultural forefront versus kind of letting the next generation move forward without having to feel the burden of that time? It's a big question, I know.
Yeah. Well, it's a great question. And it makes a lot of sense, right? I think it's the question of what is healing, I guess maybe would be the way, right? Because, you know, and I think that's one of the things I'm fascinated with. And I think there are many ways that we could imagine healing, right? Is that something that just comes about via forgetting, or is it something that is, you know, more kind of process of doing, you know, and I think about different injuries, right? Some require you to just stay off it for a week. Some require surgery, right? To use these bodily metaphors. But yeah, because I think your question is also about how this burden affects Black entrepreneurs. And I think that
or just, you know, next generations of Black Tulsans, you know.
Right. Yeah. And how do they understand themselves past?
And of course, I should say, you and I are not Black. You
know,
there's very much a conversation about, you know, don't talk about us without us. And I think that's a very real conversation to have. So I just want to kind of say, you know, there's no prescription here. We're just kind of trying to think like at the core of your work. Because I would imagine when you go into these rooms oftentimes, you know, you're a white kid from Michigan. You know, you do have some Tulsa roots. You mentioned your dad's from here. Maybe that's a barrier at the beginning. You kind of have to talk about the work you're doing and kind of, you know, feel like you're making the right introduction, just talking about these very sensitive, deeply rooted things with people that have actual familial ties to them, you know. And you're kind of like, hey, this is a project for me. And they're like, well, this is my life, you know. It can't just be a project, you know. So I just feel like, you know, I don't have an actual question there, but that's, yeah, that's such a sensitive thing you're working on.
Yeah, and I recognize, you know, I mean, I think there was, I think one of the things that I wanted to do, because I recognize that this is one of the most studied, but I mean, it is the most studied racial event in American history, right? It is everything, you know, and people have talked, you know, endlessly about this. And I think the question is, how do you come up with something new, right? That was one of the things.
I was curious to ask you that, you know, like to what end, you know, meaning like what has not been explored that you think is an area that you're focusing on?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, so for me, I think the question is, if we know so much about the victims and we've gone back so much and understood these victims, we're trying to understand the enduring legacy of this moment on Greenwood, how do we know so little about the perpetrators? So that for me, you know, and I think that's, you know, I oftentimes talk about the white mob, right? That's a historical thing and it makes sense, you know, it connects to these other mob-related events, you know, throughout the United States. It makes us look at the Red Summer and not just this kind of specific case of Tulsa, right? But one of, I think, the aspects of the one that can be a kind of shield in some ways, right? And mm-hmm. that we're talking about, you know, this could have been up to 10,000 people who did this, right? And they went on and lived their lives and didn't pass that history down. And oftentimes that was the really secretive aspect of this, right? You go back to Ed Wheeler. One of the things that I had always heard was that what was dangerous and why he received death threats was because he had actually interviewed some of the perpetrators, right? Mm, yeah. So the question was naming names, right? And that was the really, I think, dangerous part of this history. That was the secrecy attached to it. Was that it wasn't just, hey, this happened, right? Although that was at a certain point, right? That was also, I think, a line of demarcation of you don't cross this, you don't say that, right? You know, we don't even talk about this in family ways, right? When doors are closed. But I think that that secrecy was always there. And, you know, and I would go into archives, right? So that was one of the things I'm fascinated with because it's 100 years. I also understand that, you know, I'm researching this and know that there's no perpetrator alive. So for me, the question is, it's a very, I think, question of memory and of exchange.
And it's not as if people were writing detailed letters saying, hey, guess what I did? I, you know, did this horrible act and I'm telling you every detail of my motivations and all these things.
Exactly. And who, you know, and why did we come together? You know, was this part of a greater...
Mob mentality is a totally studiable thing. Yeah. How people behave in groups is so much different than how they behave as individuals.
Yeah.
I'm interested in kind of the storytelling side of the work you do.
Yeah.
Because at some point, once you've done all the research and you have this information, you have to distill it down to some way that people want to engage with, which becomes narrative and all that. I was looking today just at some works by the photographer Gordon Parks, and he did a series of photos in the civil rights era that he called Segregation Stories. Mm-hmm. And one of his most famous ones is a young black mother and a child standing outside of a theater. It's this beautiful kind of Kodachrome color photography, and it has a coloreds only sign above them. Very famous photo. Mm. And when I looked at it today, I'd seen it before, and the thing that really struck me was the fact that the sign was in neon. And what it made me think about is a neon sign has a air of permanence to it. The colored only sign entrance, colored entrance sign was this very expensive neon sign, which made you think whoever made this sign intended that to be around for a long time, you know? And the institutionalization of these cultural things, you know? It's hard for people, you know, I'm 45. I never was old enough to kind of experience legalized segregation where you would see that. You know, my father is 80. He remembers being a kid and seeing separated facilities and things like that. And I was thinking about him, I thought, when people his age who were children at that time and have the living memory of legalized segregation, that they're the carriers of that, which is not a great memory to have, but they saw what that world was, which had to be different than kind of hearing about it, you know? Because in some ways it was normalized to them. You know, my dad didn't, as a child, didn't think that was weird. You know, that was just the way the world was. It was later on, you know, when he realized that was a horrific, horrific thing. But as these people start, unfortunately, dying off and they don't have a living memory of things like that, there's a fear that these things could get forgotten or taken lighter than they actually are, you know. And so what's the responsibility of someone like you? It's a long-winded question. What's your responsibility to keep those stories alive?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, yeah, and I think segregation is a really interesting way of thinking about that. That is, I think, good to contrast with the massacre that is so, massacre is such a moment, but this is this, you know, Jim Crow is this like enduring structure,
yeah.
Right? And how do we remember that? Right, because I think in some ways, you know, with moments, it's easier to remember. They have like a time stamp on them, right? We can say every May 31st, we remember, you know, the massacre.
Yeah.
Right. And that can be just like this. And I know there's a bill right now, I believe, to make this either a national or state.
Yeah, 9/11, significant dates.
Exactly. You know, they're just like enshrined in our cultural memory. You know, and that's how I'd say, you know, that's what I think Tulsa really needs to do, or that would be, I think, great for the memory of the massacre. But yeah, I think, you know, with segregation, for example, like how do you remember that? And when do you? Right?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't have that same temporal aspect to it. But that's where I think, you know, museums are really important.
Yeah.
You know, to kind of fill in that that aspect. And you know, and of course, museums are incredibly important.
Yeah.
You know, for even the temporal stuff. So a memory type event like the massacre.
Last question is this. What's your earliest museum memory?
Okay.
And did museums play a role in your life as a kid?
Yeah, so my mom actually, she worked at the Natural History Museum of at the University of Michigan for like a couple years. It wasn't too much. But I remember just going there and then...
And this is like what, like dinosaur bones? Like,
yes, yeah. Dinosaur bones. And there's this big old bear skin.
Okay.
That I just remember that was there. Yeah, and dinosaur bones.
And that's just burned into your brain.
Yes. So.
Yeah. Have you been back to that museum ever?
No. So it's just that, you know, that place of curiosity. And, yeah. You know, and then I worked at, when I was at University of Chicago, I had my work study job at the, what was then called the Oriental Institute. Now is, I think, something for the Far East.
Yeah.
So I was a security guard there.
Oh, good.
Working, and
it's good to see different sides of the business.
Yes. Yeah. So it's cool, and then, you know, been a volunteer at the now Museum of Tulsa History.
Yeah. Formerly Tulsa Historical Society.
Correct. Yes.
Good.
And happy to be here at Gilcrease, and I'm so excited to see what happens.
It's a big new chapter.
Yes. It's going to be amazing.
A lot of big
when
stuff coming.
Yeah.
Very exciting. Well, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about the station or the museum, visit publicradiotulsa.org or philbrook.org or both. As always, we suggest both. Until next time, look closer.